This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular discussion and dialogue, I'm really delighted to have John O'Donohue, the author most recently of Eternal Echoes, Exploring Our Yearning to Belong. Prior to that, author of Anam Cara, which in Celtic means soul friend, and has been on the bestseller list in Ireland since its inception over 2.5 years ago. Many of you may be familiar with it. John, once again, it's just a total delight to have you here.
It's lovely to be here, Duncan. Bless you.
Yes, bless you, John. Thank you so much. We've become old friends here. We started out, as you mentioned, a couple of years ago. We almost had a dialogue. The machinery didn't cooperate.
That's right.
And here we are ready to dive in.
The dialogue didn't want to be held.
Yeah. Well, we had a different kind of dialogue.
We had, exactly.
Yeah. And definitely a sense of belonging and longing to renew our communication, our friendship. And in fact, that, I think, is really the heart of your book, this beautiful way in which you interrelate the sense of longing and yearning with the sense of belonging, because in our postmodern era, as you have referred to it, many of us find ourselves often with this deep feeling of alienation, of not belonging, of somehow not being embraced or understood by the culture around us, not finding a shelter that can take us in, whether it be a relationship or, as you put it, a book by Meister Eckhart or St. John of the Cross, looking for a place where we can be understood and deeply seen by another. And it's that sense of the echo that we feel, not a lonely, isolated echo coming back to us, but something that confirms and reaffirms the reality of our experience. So you talk about your experience with your father as one of the first vivid memories you have of the concept of echo, which you've now chosen for your book. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the concept of echo and why you chose that to really embody your concepts in this book.
Okay. Well, I was born in a limestone valley in the west of Ireland. And a limestone valley, I suppose, in a way, is kind of almost like an anvil all around that sounds come back. But I remember the first time my father and I were going over the mountain herding cattle. And before we reached the cattle, he called out to them. And we were near a cliff. And his call to the cattle was copied and returned precisely by the cliff. And then I tried it out, and it returned my call as well. And it was a fascinating thing for me that suddenly in the midst of lonesome nature out there in the wilds, that there was some secret resonant heart at the center of the rock which heard and returned perfectly the human voice. And it struck me that at the heart of silence there is a resonance of warmth, and that we do belong in the world, even though we don't belong to the world. And I suppose the key to what I was trying to say in Eternal Echoes is that the human heart is a theatre of longings, and that there is all kinds of longing within us. There's the longing to find meaning, which is crucial. There's the longing to be loved. There's also the longing to be seen. I mean, it has always struck me as incredibly interesting that no human being has ever seen her or his own face. that even though when people know you on the street and that, they recognize you not by the clothes you wear, though they do sometimes, but they recognize you because they know your face. That's what recognition is. And yet you yourself have never seen your own face. It's a fascinating thing. All you've seen are images and mirrors and windows. And as we know, mirrors are notoriously treacherous. Some mirrors are so cruel, and what they image back to you, you'd want to hide and put away, more or more gentle.
Let me just jump in for 1 second here and mention that's so fascinating that you say that, because in traditional Buddhist teachings, as exposited by the Tibetans in particular, they describe the word transmission, which is the wondrous event that happens between guru and student in that particular kind of friendship, that the student is awakened to his own face. The translation in Tibetan of the word transmission means literally to introduce you to your own face, and that is the gift of the relationship.
I think that's beautiful, because I think the face is that place of visual signature and unique intimacy of the life. In a certain sense, I often think that the secret eternity within us, behind the face, is what gradually over a lifetime actually artistically shapes the texture, the line, and the presence in the face. It's almost as if it crowds to the surface in us. It's almost as if, you know, in the beginning, that there's a lovely parallel, a mirroring going on between the great evolution, which brought out of the anonymity of nature the intimacy of the human face. And I often think that the first time the human face appeared on the earth must have been an incredible moment for nature, that here at last was the deepest intimacy which had arrived. I often imagine that the seas went silent and the winds stilled in acknowledgement of that icon of creation. And similarly, I believe in one's individual life, that what you're here in a way to do is to make your soul, but maybe in a way that is visually represented in the way that your face is made, in the way that you fill your face over time through what you do with your life and what life does to you, and that that inner conversation finds a visual consequence or sacramentality in the presence of the face.
And I'm going to now, with your permission, read from a portion of your book called The First Journey Creates the Traveler, in which you say it as follows. Our parents set us on this journey from darkness into light, from anonymity to intimacy, when they make love and conceive us. We forget that our very conception emerged out of the passionate act of their longing for each other. It is no surprise, then, that we are filled with desire. Each of us is literally a child of longing. On its journey to humanity, the embryo actually travels through all the shapes of evolution. Each of these embryonic shapes becomes ever more personal until the blur of forms finally clarifies as the baby's body and the intimacy of a human countenance emerges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to share that with our listeners, so beautifully stated.
Yeah, I think that it's amazing, you know, that on our, we're always journeying, you see, in human life. Like I journeyed from Connemara to Boulder here in beautiful Colorado. And I left my village and came through all this empty space over land and sea and air until I arrived here. So I left a point and arrived at a point. And that's what journeys are all about. But it's fascinating that the first journey, our first journey into the universe, is actually a unique and different journey, because it's the first journey that creates the traveler coming in. So that actually the journey makes us. The journey is our way of emerging. And maybe in another way, something I hadn't thought of before, but maybe the other side of it is that our last journey here unmakes the traveler and maybe recreates a new kind of traveler for the eternal world, you know? I also think that within us, even though our bodies are visually empirical objects, and that's where you meet a person is in their body. But our minds are nomadic kind of wanderers, and we're always going from landscape to landscape within and travelling and travelling. And I think that part of the passion and creativity of a life is the quality of its wanderings. I've done different styles of belonging in the book. There's the visitor, the neighbour, the native, and the wanderer and the stranger. And I think that there's some of that in all of us, you know, and that maybe the goal of human authenticity is not just sincerity, which can be very bland and one-chambered and just repetitive and linear. But maybe the goal is a kind of authenticity rather than, which includes sincerity, but which awakens as many chambers and territories in the heart as possible. So that when you come to your death, it would be lovely to imagine that you had honored all the latent presences in you, so that they were there all around you and awake with you as you all, the whole crowd of you, went through the doorway.
And into what some mystics have called the next step, which is the eternal journey into God.
Mm-hmm.
That the first part of the journey is to find or to connect with what we call God, or mm-hmm. what could be called the divinity, and then the eternal journey into God. And I would like to, at this point, invite you to talk about the portion of your book which is called The Blessings of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as we know, in traditional Buddhist analysis of the mind, the first noble truth is that of suffering, which is the longing, the yearning, the dissatisfaction with what we experience from our limited perspective. And the second noble truth he identifies as the cause of suffering, which is desire and attachment. And it's important that we see desire and attachment, because all desire does not have to lead to attachment. And properly understood, as you point out in the book, it can actually lead to this liberation and sense of deep, deep belonging.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a crucial distinction. I do think then, and I've dealt with them a bit in the book, that there are certain forms of desire, like obsession, addiction, negativity, the false shapes of belonging, which the prisons within which we choose to live, chapter 3, where desire fixates us, atrophies us, and quietly numbs our longing. But I think that the real nature of longing is a kind of intentionality that wants to bring us in more to the landscapes of our own immensity, and wants to help us realize and birth within ourselves all of the great gifts that we have. I often think that everything we need for the journey has already been given to us, but that we are often blind to it, and we behave like paupers, even though we are all heirs to incredible riches which are just half an inch away from us within our own hearts. We search elsewhere, and we go out of ourselves all the time looking for what we actually have. And I think that where does the longing come from is a question I try to explore as well. And you see, I think that the nature of God is actually longing, in that sense of the loyalty and faithfulness to absolute creativity, because absolute creativity is absolute presence, and God is absolute presence. And I think that it's very interesting to look at Julian of Norwich, particularly in relation to this. And I have a little quotation from her on the flyleaf of the book, which says that when God was talking to her in these great showings that she had, God said to her, "Behold, I am the ground of thy beseeching," which translated could mean, "Behold, I am the ground of your longing," or "Behold, that the longing that you have is I seeking myself in you."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is an indication that human longing is an echo of divine longing, mm-hmm. or an imprint of divine longing. But that then that the adventure becomes really exciting, because one of the things that Western culture, and I suppose all cultures do it in a way because of the fear element and the unknown, is the domestication of divinity. Like, something that really interests me at the moment, which I'm doing a good bit of work on, is the whole presence of Jesus. And I was thinking, you know, that there's no more domesticated figure in the Western tradition than Jesus. The way he's functionalized and used by all kinds of systems, and turned into a very predictable kind of safe compromiser, which he wasn't at all. Like, he was dangerous.
Quite the contrary. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he
very
went
dangerous.
For the mountains,
yeah.
And he went for the solitude. And he had, this is what I'm working on, he had all these years of preparation before he ever emerged, like, at all. And mm-hmm. Meister Eckhart is very good on this. Meister Eckhart says that it makes no difference if there was an incarnation, unless it happens in your soul. And he talked beautifully about the birth of God and the soul. He also said that he has this amazing phrase, which is, in Mittelhochdeutsch, Gott entwirrt, God unbecomes. werden is to become, and int werden is unbecoming. So God unbecomes. That means that God is only our name for it. And the closer we get to it, the more it ceases to be God. Because then the control, the manacles of our ego, sophistication of our subconscious strategies to protect ourselves become transfigured in some way.
And you merge, you
that's
become.
Right. That's
you,
right. Yeah. That's right. But I think
you disappear.
Yeah.
But
I think, yeah, I think that you also, I think the fascinating thing about the concept of God that I like most is the Christian concept of the Trinity. Because I think there is in that an incredible metaphor and image and presence of diversity in this amazing kind of unity. And I think in the imagination of God, into which we will gradually unite all of us, that God, that there is nothing outside God. God is the largest embrace in the universe. And that each one of us comes from a different place in that divine circle. And that we come out, and our duty is to realize all that we carry, so that when we come back in, the circle is deeply enriched. But that the beauty of the eternal life, I think, is that our individuality will neither be erased, suppressed, or suffused into an anonymous unity, but that we will literally come home into the heart of divinity, where the narrative and memory of our experience and the horizons of our possibility will be beautifully harmonized.
What that calls to my mind is month of June in 1998, when I spent an entire month in Bombay reading a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita by one of India's most well-known swamis in India, not so well-known in the West. And I remember this particular shlok or stanza from the Gita in which Krishna, in talking to Arjuna, says, "Creatures rise, creatures vanish, but I alone am real, Arjuna, looking out amused from deep within the eyes of every creature. Hold me close, Arjuna, because I am more you than you yourself are."
Oh, isn't that beautiful? That's profound. Yeah. You know what's going on there, I think, is that beautiful subversion of the subject-object distinction and that kind of distancing reflexivity. And it's bringing individuality and otherness together in a beautiful way. Meister Eckhart said exactly the same thing in another way. He said, "The eye with which I see God is God's eye seeing me," which is the same. You could think about a sentence like that forever, you know.
You could, in fact, yes. Yeah. And the other thing in your book that was paired with that for me as I read it was a quotation from Blake that I'd never heard before, in which he said, "Christ the imagination."
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we could talk about that, how by accessing our imagination and our creativity, it is our way not to express an egoistic individuality, but to actually come home to the deep reality of who we really are.
Mm-hmm. I think you see that in Western Christian theology, that we have become obsessed with and concentrated exclusively on the intellect of God and the will of God. And the will of God was always used. Every time you heard the will of God, you knew you were in trouble. Like, you knew you weren't living up to it, you weren't harmonizing with it. And the ones that were over you in church authority or whatever, like, demanded this of you externally. And as many as the lovely person ruined and damaged the sacred complexity of their souls trying to fit into a mechanical notion of the will of God. And I think that has been so sinister. The other thing was the intellect of God, you know. And like, how did God set the whole thing going, you know? And then Aristotle came up with this, the coolest, it must be the coolest image, like, in all of world philosophy, the idea of the unmoved mover, like, the unmoved one who's there. He can't even bat an eyelid or something will go off, like, but he does change something and then the whole thing begins to move. I mean, it's absurd, you know. But I think that the dimension of the deity that has been totally neglected in all of this is the imagination of God.
From an institutional reality, imagination is heresy.
Absolutely, it is. That's why, like, the Stalinists, the dictators, always go for the artists first. Mm-hmm. They're the ones they want to get rid of, because they know that it's not in their nature to really conform, but to explore otherwise outside the fold. I really think that the imagination of God is an incredibly wild kind of thing, and that there's nothing in the universe as wild as God. And it is that a word used by Thomas Aquinas, it's a Greek word, the pleroma, the fullness of the divine presence. To put it in a very colloquial, banal kind of way, had God who tries to create the world and create us in this breathing, swelling, intense, luminous diversity. He hadn't, I think. I think if God hadn't created, he would have broke down and be in some divine lunatic asylum in the heavens mm-hmm. somewhere. So I think that each one of us is created and fashioned in mm-hmm. the image and likeness of the divine imagination. And when we inhabit our imagining, and when we imagine deeply, we are really original. Then we are really in the rhythm of our deepest individuality, the things that the medievals and scholastic called ineffabile, that ineffable thing within us which no word or category can touch, which is essentially a sacred wildness. Mm-hmm. And I think that then we are in the wild with the divine. Eckhart has a sentence, God is that wilderness in which everyone is alone. But I like the image of wildness better from my own home place in the west of Ireland, that often over the limestone you'd see a fox running, russet fox against the grey rock, and the beauty of the and the elegance of the fox's swiftness. And I think there is in wildness a certain seamless elegance, and I think that's in the divine. I also think that it's within us, and that part of the excitement of a life that concentrates a little bit on the horizons of soul and spirit is that it actually calls its own wildness alive.
Before you read your next poem, what I'd like to do is just comment with a reference to Harvey Cox's article in March of 1999 in the Atlantic Monthly, in which he points out that for many people, their minds and consciousness are dominated by what he calls the new religion of the market. Even though they don't recognize it as a religion, it has become a seamless belief system that permeates people so deeply that they're not even aware how much of their behavior is controlled by it. And he says, in part, Harvey Cox, that the older religions encourage archaic attachments to particular places. But in the market's eyes, all places are interchangeable. The market prefers a homogenized world culture with as few inconvenient particularities or complexities as possible. The market prefers strongly individualism and mobility and becomes wrathful when people cling to local traditions. These belong to the older dispensations and, like the high places of the Balim, should be plowed under.
That's excellent. That's precisely like what he's saying there, I think, is like something that I've always felt about the market thing. Because everything now, the market and the God of quantity are in mm-hmm. the one game. And I think that the enemy for the market is particularity, which respects itself or has mm-hmm. poise within itself. And what the market is essentially is the exotic kind of extension of a bland new anonymity. Mm-hmm. Where all countenance is gradually erased, you know.
It's 1984, an Orwellian.
That's right.
Brave New World.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe at this point, because we're getting kind of heavy again, I might read an old poem called Bannocht, which is the Gaelic word for blessing, and there's another Gaelic word in the poem, the word Corach, which is a word for a little boat. And I'd read this for all our listeners as a kind of invocation and blessing for us in these challenging and difficult times. Bannocht. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays and the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life.
Beautiful. And I think your comment that we're getting a little bit on the serious side there is well taken, because these things do invite serious reflection, but they also invite us, as you put it, to see and experience with the wild eye of the soul. And I feel I must at this point tell the story of our first encounter, when I had a water bottle with me in the back of a room where you were about to go forward and give the talk as the featured speaker. and you didn't have any water around, and you saw that I had this water bottle, and you asked if I could pour a little bit into your empty coffee cup. And so this water bottle, like many that you have for sports, had a little nipple on the top so that you could drink it while running. And as I was starting to pour the water in through the nipple, and it was going very slowly, you simply... You reached over and you unscrewed the top and you poured all the blessings in very directly and very efficiently. And I thought, why didn't I see that? And I said, I didn't see that. And you said, well, Duncan, it's the Celtic way.
It's probably excess desperation in my behalf, kind of gone on to give an old talk and the throat fairly dry.
Right. But so beautiful, you know, just that little moment of that great sense of humor, because I was in whatever mode the product was suggesting, you know, to have the little trickle out, and then you saw through it and you just opened it. And I mean, we don't have to belabor the metaphor, but it struck me that it's very similar to what you're saying here, is that we can see outside the box, as the comfortable cachet has it, but I think it really is profound that we see outside our conditioning when we look with the wild eye of the soul.
I agree with you. And in Irish culture, I suppose at home, you know, we've had to do that. We've had no choice, you know, because we had 800 years of intense visitation, not just visitation, but remaining by our larger neighbor on the other larger neighboring island.
On the other side of the pale.
That's right. Yes. Who felt that they knew what was best for us. Mm-hmm. So we had 800 years of very relentless colonization and awful suffering. And I mean, we celebrated the famine there last couple of years, you know, the 150th anniversary of the famine. And awful things happened. Like 1 million people died at home, a couple of million immigrated. Why? Like, this is what really makes me so sad, you know. It's not fashionable to say this now in Ireland. It's politically incorrect. But, like, while the people were starving to death, and I remember this is still in the memory of my family. Like, my father remembers his grandfather seeing people out the mountain dead by the walls of fields and their mouths green because they'd been eating grass with the hunger. Like, that shows you the hunger. Mm-hmm. And while they were dying of that starvation, ships were leaving Cove Harbour laden down with grain, laden down with all kinds of food. I mean, Christy Moore and Sinead O'Connor have great songs about that, you know. So that's really lonely. And I think that part of the thing in the old Irish psyche is that massive crucifixion of consciousness went on there. And that the only way around it, like, is you can't take the dull thud of pain in every breath. You have to send it up and you have to be humorous and you have to be able to laugh. And laugh not in a forced way, but laugh from your heart. Mm-hmm. That's why I think Beckett is such an Irish writer. Mm-hmm. Beckett can describe landscapes where a state coroner or even a divine coroner wouldn't get one pulse of presence, and yet you hear the laughter on all sides. You know, it's black humor, but it's great. There's great energy in it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And so we could rephrase it and say thinking outside the pale.
That's right. Exactly.
The wild mind finds its dark and liberating humor.
That's right.
You know, yes,
that's
yes, right. Yes, she said yes, yes, yes. It's an affirmation in the face of everything that could lead to despair.
That's right. That's right.
Well, perhaps now would be a time for you to read the conclusion of your book, which I think really segues very beautifully from what we've just said as we're coming to the end, regretfully, of this latest dialogue.
Lovely. Well, I'll read the last paragraph because I think that it kind of brings the whole energy of longing and belonging together. And, you know, when you're writing a book, like, you know this yourself, it's romantic when you have a book written, like, oh, you wrote the book. Like, but the bringing a book to birth is a very painful thing. And there's mornings when you'd write for 4 hours and you think you had 6 or 7 pages that were really great. And you'd look at them the next day when you get up and you'd say, how could I have seen anything in them at all? You know, but there was fierce pressure on to complete the book by a deadline. And my American editor at HarperCollins, Diane Reverend, who's a lovely lady, you know, gave me as much space as she absolutely could to complete it. But I remember I was staying up all hours into the night and up very early in the morning. But I remember one morning at 6 o'clock, just as the light was breaking over Connemara, that I wrote this paragraph, and I knew it was the last paragraph. So it sums up nicely, I think, the energy of the old longing and belonging. In the pulse beat is the life and the longing, all embraced in the great circle of belonging, reaching everywhere, leaving nothing and no one out. This embrace is mostly concealed from us who climb the relentless and vanishing escalator of time and journey outside where space is lonesome with distance. All we hear are whispers, All we see are glimpses. But each of us has the divinity of imagination which warms our hearts with the beauty and depth of a world woven from glimpses and whispers, an eternal world that meets the gaze of our eyes and the echo of our voices to assure us that from all eternity we have belonged, and to answer the question that echoes at the heart of all longing. While we are here, where is it that we are absent from?
And with that, John O'Donohue, I guess we need to close this latest dialogue. And thank you so much for being with us. It's just been a sheer delight, a joyful, dark and light experience of the highest order.
I really enjoyed it, Duncan. Bless you and bless all your conversations.
And all of our listeners, you've been listening to John O'Donohue and Duncan Campbell here on Living Dialogues. John O'Donohue's latest book, Eternal Echoes, Exploring Our Yearning to Belong. He is indeed in the flesh an Anam Kara, a deep and true spiritual friend. Thank you again, John.
Bless you. Thank you.
Be with us next time on Living Dialogues.
And visit us on my website, livingdialogues.com. That's living, DIALOGUES.com. And if you'd like to listen freely to additional archived visionary dialogues with myself and other transformational thinkers listed on my livingdialogues.com website, once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. Or simply browse through the list of programs here whenever you like, download them, or listen to them on your computer. Thanks again for your deep listening in evoking this program. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.